It is my pleasure indeed to introduce today's speaker. She's a very unusual lady. She came to RMIT as a secretary in international division many years ago, and she's now progressed as a result of her doctorate to being appointed as a research fellow in the School of Global Studies. You're going to hear of a very courageous journey that she's been undertaking and is in the middle of. I'll let her speak for herself on that matter. So, with great pleasure, I ask her to come forward, Yasha Nadarajah, Associate Professor of RMIT Global Studies Area.
Good afternoon to each and every one of you, and thank you to the Rotary Club Melbourne for this wonderful opportunity to speak about a ground-up community project in one of the remotest parts of Papua New Guinea. My name is Yasha Nadarajah. I'm a development sociologist working at RMIT. My work, especially over the last 10 years, has been in trying to understand more deeply how communities, and particularly those most vulnerable and poor, live on a day-to-day basis. And in what way can we learn and work with each other to make our lives that much more livable and humane? Over time, I'm coming to realize how much working and being with those most marginalized is helping me, both in my work and my life, to compose a mosaic that is increasingly revealing a delicate new perspective, a new perspective for grasping the world's reality, and in that process, a more creative, meaningful, and mutually productive approach to particularly development work as such. I first traveled to PNG in 2007 as part of a research team to work with the PNG government on developing an integrated community development policy. Our fieldwork carried us across many of the provinces, and yet when we launched the policy and also our in-depth research, I felt that despite well-intentioned government strategies and global support, conventional approaches to development were in many ways, also in some ways, contributing to the country's slow decline. In 2016, the country numbered 6.8 million citizens. The UNDP program of 2015 indicates that 37% of that population still lives below the national poverty line, positioning it at 154 out of 188 countries. 87% of Papua New Guineans live rurally, 40% are under the age of 15. Life expectancy still remains at 63 years for men and 68 years for the women. And of the 6.8 million, 3.7 million live in remote locations with little or no infrastructure and services. Many have little contact with one another, let alone with the outside world, and live within a non-monetized economy dependent on subsistence agriculture. I think in many ways a state-led development has also created competition for resources. And many development projects do not know how to engage with the complexity of community, struggling to hold both culture, custom, and nation. And community kinship systems such as the One Talk system is now more blatantly used to serve personal agendas, and it has become both explosive and divisive. This intersection of the tribal and the modern have become places for new conflicts and problems. And the increasing role of multinational partners, China, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, Malaysia, the Philippines, Indonesia, India, has also in some ways further distant Papua New Guineans from their own progress and ownership, fueling even more violence and ethnic divisions. But at the same time, our research also showed that despite the crisis, people in Papua New Guinea still live in resilient, community-based relationships with one another. This is particularly so in remote regions, despite the fact that remote communities have become even more marginalized, the two-hub basket, with government relying on mining companies to provide services. There is a reason for humility. And increasingly through this ground-up approach that I will talk about shortly, I've become even more heartened that a creative and dynamic ground-up response to the demands of everyday life and local global pressures will be led out of Papua New Guinea. I first met the elders in 2011. They had seen me when I had done some work in the areas and maybe felt that I could trust them. The Kukuku is a remote tribal community, approximately 98,000 people, numbering 12 clans. They live in the Manyamnya district in the Morobe province. They are a Stone Age people, and over the years have acquired a profile as a warring and fierce cannibalistic people. For many, this reputation has also been tied to the fact that they resisted the large-scale resource extraction activities, mainly gold, from the early 1930s, and continue to do so in various ways. I took up their invitation to visit their land and villages and gain a much deeper understanding of their lives and the huge challenges they were facing. I think, you know, I had also become somewhat disillusioned by development strategies, as was increasingly finding the term grumpy and difficult to work with, circumventing within my earshot. So the elders were keen to share their ideas about development and well-being, and I grabbed the invitation gladly. I still remember that early evening. The light was fading, and as I entered deeper into the jungles, I thought of all the words that folks from Port Moresby and the urban areas had said to me. They are a Stone Age people, absolutely primitive and cannibalistic. Are you crazy? But I had such a powerful instinct that their invitation was sincere, full of hope for a better future by working together. But still, I thought I should clear some key things first. So in my most professional voice, of course, and as the tribe was dancing their welcome, these words stumbled out of my mouth to the elder, who seemed to be the key authority for the place. Do you still eat people? One of the guys who spoke some English translated. The elder turned, looked at me, and then with a smile, reached out, held my cheek and said, "Haven't tried Indian." I wonder what he would have said if I talked to him about Valentine's Day. He might have said, "Haven't tried Indian garnished with red roses and heart-shaped chocolates," maybe. In this remote part of Papua New Guinea, an innocuous exchange and a window into a grounded people, maybe with a good sense of humor. I was somewhat quite pleased. Each village I visited was different, reminding me of Papua New Guinea's great diversity, even within one tribal community. These greetings varied in their intensity and practice. And I spent a good part of 2012 traveling to some of the villages of this remote tribal community. The roads, mainly left unattended after the mining activities, are one of the most difficult terrains to maneuver. We couldn't have made it if the villagers had not walked down and pulled us out of the mud. I still remember how one stretch of 9 kilometers took us more than 8 hours to maneuver. I engaged with this community in many very different ways and talked about development. And in 2013, came back with the idea of the development tree. And this fitted so well into the tribal knowledge of the living sacred tree of life and growth, strengthening the roots of the local, consolidating the trunk through partnerships, and then the branches will flourish. 2 small seed funds from a trust company in 2013 and 2015 helped me to initiate some projects in the region based on the ideas that the various villages came up with, to develop small-scale communal farms that would not only provide nutritious food and employment, but also open up opportunities to sell to surrounding companies and other rural and urban communities in the region and beyond. Small amounts of funds were given to identified groups across 11 villages. These projects were chosen by the communities themselves, and the money was handed over publicly and accounted for by the tribal house of men called the Houseman and the tribal house of women called House Mary. These cultural houses of tribal governance and cultural knowledge had lost their roles post-independence. This project was also assisting in reviving some of those valuable cultural practices that very quickly played a significant part in maintaining mutual respect, accountability, and also transparency in the acquittal of funds at the local level and also for RMIT at the Melbourne end. As the project started to grow rapidly, I greatly felt the need for guidance and critical feedback. Respected leaders like Professor Bain Lent, former Vice Chancellor of RMIT University, Dr. Janine Kirk, Princess Charities, among others, accepted my invitation, and an advisory council was set up in 2014. The council, much like the House Man and House Mary, continues to hold a safe and energizing space for critical feedback and holding the integrity of the project. You know, of course, you know, it takes much effort to work through processes to arrive at mutually culturally rich practice, but the efforts continue to be so rewarding because it brings with it so many unexpected outcomes. For the leaders of these projects, many who do not read or write, signing the acceptance of the money with a wobbly X mark was one of great pride, responsibility, and ownership. To date, community has invested more than 80% into this project, a powerful and compelling indication of the engagement and creative input. This engagement has also helped us to build intra-tribal solidarity and a great momentum to leverage on collaborative partnerships and learnings. Projects that were initiated such as this, such as the Pig Farm Collective, and these projects bring in together a large number of families. For example, this particular pig collective has more than 36 families, which means that you're talking about 200 to 300 people. The women's retail store or the farm also brought in traditional practices that work well with modern monetization processes. For example, as the pig farm started to grow in size from 7 to 17, the group lent the boar to another village wanting to set up. The barter was 2 piglets from the new litter. So in this way, the women's retail group too used the profits from the shop to buy a sewing machine and have added clothes to their shop. There isn't enough time today to go through all the 17 projects, but suffice to say that the community's confidence in learning with our collaboration through addressing resource management, design, and so forth, has raised valuable insights and significant opportunities for how we could sustain and flourish in remote areas. Growing confidence is also seeing the community building communal bush buildings such as the local Global House, where we ran our first training session. A significant exploration into locally based cash crop production opportunities such as turmeric, peanuts, and mushrooms has also brought into the project final year RMIT engineering and international development students. In 2017, 2 engineering students took up turmeric processing machines for use in a remote region. Community groups working with these prototype machines have demonstrated the ability to respond to new learning and skills and opened up the real possibility of setting up cash crop enterprises locally. RMIT students have also plunged into learning how to respond to real-world applications and are learning about protecting valuable natural resources and working together with traditional knowledge to create sustainable machines and projects. The local community pulling together their traditional weaving and a combination of engineering and traditional to create a water tank that we made out of bamboo, which makes the bamboo water tank more accessible to everyone rather than waiting for tanks to come up from the urban areas. This project is also turning the notion of remote regions on its head. Remote regions are not a liability and a problem to be addressed, but a valuable asset. These remote places hold a fine capillary system of interconnected people, places, agency, and resilience. When nurtured and nourished, a remote region can offer profoundly transformative contribution to national development, mitigate unsustainable urban migrations, contribute to climate change mitigation and environmental protection. In 2016, I ran a pilot program for the 25 project leaders that would enable them to combine their local knowledge and rich cultural repository with contemporary knowledge. This training program that I call SLEGA systemic livelihood and income-generating activities was also designed to build what I call agri-entrepreneurs, who are able to use agriculture as an economic tool to overcome poverty and build transformative local global coalitions. This pilot program reaffirmed the ability of the local to engage creatively and competently when learning opens up the space for the mutual exchange of knowledge, local, global, urban, remote. At this juncture, as projects are deepening and community engagement is expanding, it's becoming very clear that the current team of project and community leaders are getting really overwhelmed with this rapidly growing project. From 200 people in 2012 who initiated the invitation, this project has grown to include more than 9,000 people across the Manyemya district in just 4 years. The focus of this project is now on extending the training, developing the capacity of 200 new project leaders across the 11 villages by 2020 to work with this foundation group of leaders and young people. And to finish off, I want to say, to finish by saying that the goals of this local global eco-enterprise are compelling, committed, and shared. To develop sustainable models of resource management and agri-entrepreneurship, expand commerce within the region and the world, build lifelong learning and employment opportunities for young people, build local solidarity and global partnerships, and offer viable enterprise models for other remote communities. Mahatma Gandhi often reminded his people that an eye for an eye can often make the whole nation blind. And as Albert Einstein has said, peace cannot be kept by force. It can only be achieved by understanding. And for me, in the last 4 years, this deeper understanding of each other, remote and urban, local and global, is showing us what is possible, opening up the spaces for solidarity, building new combinations of the tribal and the modern towards overcoming poverty and conflict. And that I believe that that transformative change is well on its way. When I told the Kukuku elders and the project leaders in Papua New Guinea that I'll be speaking of the project today here at Rotary International in the middle of Melbourne, they said they would all sit quietly during this time and be with us in spirit. And so I conclude by ending by saying, for myself and for them, I thank you so much for your time and for listening to us. Thank you.